Thank you. Returning to the theme of metamorphosis, I'm going to give an overview of the evolution of pest management in two locations, Australia and Washington State, both of which I've been fortunate enough to work in viticulture over the last 20 plus years. So beginning with Australia, a little bit of background information on the history. Viticultural industry has quite a long history there. The first vines were grown in 1788, but it wasn't until the 1980s and 1990s that the industry really took off. And it was based on being clean and green. And this was basically a response to the European demand, which was the export direction that the product was going to, their demand for no pesticide residues. So they really had to become clean and green to get to that market. And then in the 1990s and 2000, the markets expanded into Canada and US and the rest of Europe and the UK. But Australia was very fortunate in having few viticultural arthropod pests. So they were able to adopt clean and green relatively easy. There are a few significant concerns, and it's been interesting listening to the previous talks about some obviously very serious pests that Australia does not have. There are no what you'd call a key devastating pest like the things we heard about this morning that occurs in every viticultural region in every season. There are pests, of course, but they are minor and sporadic in comparison. And basically, they boil down to these three groups. Some mites, which are not spider mites, they're bunch and rust mites, or areophytes and tenuopalpid mites. The light brown apple moth, which we heard a little bit about earlier, and mealybugs. They're really the major concerns. Some viticultural areas have specific problems with other pests, but they're very localized. So generally, overall, these are the pests that they have to contend with. So once the industry took the export to Europe route, and of course, you know, Australia is a big country, but there are very few people who live in there. I think the population of New York State is the population of Australia. So for a grape grower to have a living and to make a profit, they needed to export. I mean, export was imperative for industry expansion and survival. And it was, you know, with those pests that they had, it was relatively easy to pursue clean and green. So back in 1982, before the industry really took off in this direction, these were the sort of chemicals that were being used. And they're all broad spectrum, heavy duty materials that were highly disruptive to the system. After the export push, these are the chemicals that were used, basically. Bacillus thuringiensis, a bacterial preparation for the light brown apple moth, sulfur for the mites, and this is wettable sulfur rather than lime sulfur, which I'll mention in a minute. There's a big difference in effect on natural enemies. And spray oils. These are basically the materials that were used back in the 90s. So a case study here on the mites, which I have quite a bit of experience in over there doing my research. During 92 to 97, we surveyed approximately 50 or more vineyards over all the viticultural regions on the eastern side of the country. And only a handful of spider mites were ever found, despite adjacent crops that had greater inputs, chemical inputs, having plenty. They didn't colonize grapevines to any great extent. In fact, only two vineyards had spider mites, and both of these were characterized by using Lawsban for specific problems that they had. But other mites, the aerophytes, the bunch mites, and the rust mites were common, but this is where our research was aimed at that time. They were ripe for development of biologically based low input management. And we came up with a strategy of using beneficials, predatory mites in particular, and changing the inputs, the chemical inputs that were being used, to come up with a biological control program, conservation biological control, that we called Wine, Women and Vineyard Mite Control with Doreen and Victoria. And this was based on exploiting native phytosad populations, which were present in most vineyards, but not every vineyard. We did a bit of mass culturing of particular species, Doreen and Victoria, and introducing them to certain areas that didn't have them and certain vineyards. And some attempt to develop vineyards as good phytosad habitat by using some plants that we knew the phytosad overwintered in, and basically conservation of this assemblage of mite predators. And beside the phytosads, there are groups of other predators that are involved too. One of the key things was the removal of lime sulfur and the fungicide mancozeb from spray programs. Both of these materials we found were highly toxic to the two predators that were the most important components of managing the mites. And so once we got rid of those and we assisted in the conservation of predators, the mite problem was much reduced. As I said, we did some vineyard releases of mass-reared Doreen and Victoria, which were Typhlodromus dorinae and Amblyesis victoriensis, and the growers sort of liked the names Doreen and Victoria. And since that time, there's been some problems with these mites again during spring, where applications of sulfur are now required, and I'll talk more about that later because it's echoed in Washington viticulture too. We have a similar problem. Light brown apple moth, we heard briefly about that this morning. It is a minor sporadic pest of most of Australian viticulture. It doesn't do very well particularly in the areas that I was working in the hot, dry, outback areas where viticulture depends on irrigation. It never really took off during the summer. It was only a significant problem in the cooler, moister areas. But it was well managed in most instances, using various IPM strategies, and we heard some of those from Jeff this morning, using ground covers, biological control, and occasionally an insect growth regulator or even mating disruption. But it certainly wasn't the ferocious pest that the California situation would lend us to believe at the moment. These are just some of the images I found on the internet the other day. It's sort of a non-event over there. So IPM in Australian viticulture has been low input and sustainable since the early 1990s. And the catalyst for change was the need to export and the necessity to meet European market pest residue requirements. And the good fortune was that, you know, there was a lack of serious pests in Australian vineyards. Being an isolated continent, it still doesn't have a lot of the potential grapevine pests that it could have. And with the the quarantine that they have there, you know, these things are hopefully unlikely to get there. And also, you know, the one thing I haven't mentioned is that there was and is, well, obviously still is, but there was a progressive public attitude towards reducing pesticide usage back in the 80s and 90s when I was working there. I mean, that was the main driving force even at that time for our research, reducing pesticide usage. And there are a number of reasons for that. There was a lot of pesticide residue scare stories where other exports from Australia, like beef, were caught up in residue problems. And so the whole, you know, public attitude was towards reducing pesticide usage. So we now switch to Washington State, where I moved in 1999, and the snow wasn't the only difference from the outback. I came across, you know, viticulture as being a very different system. Pesticides were still king. They were, unavoidable. They were highly used. And I was quite shocked at the time. In fact, I think my first NSOP meeting in December 99, I presented a talk similar to the title there, which was actually published in the Australian Great Grower Winemaker, and I realised at that point I wasn't cut out to be a politician. I was just so staggered by the difference that I felt compelled to tell the world about it. And of course, the people that had just hired me and welcomed me to Washington to work on grape viticulture were not very pleased. But, you know, the reality was that pesticide applications on grapes were frequent and the basis of vineyard pest management in Washington. these were the materials that were being used in 1999, and similar to the materials that I showed you before that were used in Australia in 1982 and were stopped very soon after that. Carbaryl, chlorpyrifos, all those materials are broad spectrum, heavy duty, and you know, applications of those early season, which were used, whether they were needed or not, just led to, you know, an impossible situation for good IPM and biological control for the rest of the season. And at that time, there was an average of about 1.3 pounds of insecticide active ingredient. So that's just the active ingredient applied over the industry. And obviously, it was a badly disrupted ecosystem, and most of the pests that were perceived as problems and were problems were induced pests. And spider mites was a great example, and also mealybugs. As I said, those pesticides were generally used by a lot of growers, most growers, to start every season. So looking at the history of Washington viticulture, it's also had a fairly long history, but it didn't get into full stride until fairly recently, until the 1990s actually. It was, you know, from about the 1970s to the 1990s, it was riding on California's coattails, and you know, there was very little production really, but from 1992 to 2000, it doubled, and it's still increasing now. So that it is second to California in production of grapes and wine. It's still a long way behind California, obviously, but it really is an expanding viticultural area. But again, you know, another difference from Australia is that production is mostly still for domestic market. There's some, you know, efforts to for exports, but it is mostly for domestic consumption. And the industry is based on production of quality wines. They pride themselves on that, and the wines certainly are good quality. And of course, you know, at that time, in the early 2000, 1999, the pressure was and still is to ensure the best possible crop outcome. And so there was a great dependence on pesticides. And there was few, you know, unlike the Australian situation, pesticide residue barriers. I mean, there wasn't much monitoring for the domestic market at that time. I'm still not sure if there's much now, to be honest, but they certainly didn't have to satisfy overseas markets for pesticide residues. And the other difference that was striking to me was the input of pesticide companies and associated scouting services, where they were combined, you know, so that you had pesticide companies or representatives of giving scouting advice and pest management advice, which was very different from Australia, where most of the consultants were independent. And so naturally there was some, you know, unavoidable input from the pesticide companies in marketing the pesticides. One of my first memories of being in Washington at that time and looking at vineyards and going around and seeing one of these guys, pesticide consultant, seeing one spider mite in a vineyard and saying, "That has to be sprayed." You know, that was a total shock. But the pests that occur in Washington vineyards are fairly, like Australia, not really hugely significant. They are. These are the ones that of most importance in 1999, and all of them can be very damaging if the system's disrupted. But none of them is really a pest that you find every season in every vineyard. They're sporadic and fairly moderate. So there was a glimmer of hope there to, you know, if we could reduce the pesticide inputs to do a similar thing to what we did in Australia to get better biological control and selective management of these pests. As I said, none of these pests are key. There's about half the number that are present in California vineyards. So, you know, we have a fairly good situation pest-wise. And most of them are good candidates for biological or cultural control. Grape leafhoppers are probably the most widespread familiar pest to grape growers, but you know, their large numbers are needed before they cause economic damage. They don't tend to occur in the same densities that they occur in California. But, you know, back in 99, they were controlled by those materials I showed before. And usually sprays were put on prophylactically early in the season without regard for monitoring or anything else. They were just put on in anticipation of the populations. So that was one of the first things that we looked at to try and improve biological control. We did a lot of work on Anagaris. I had a student, Chris Storm, looking at Anagaris, and we found out a lot about the species we have and their biology, and came up with some strategies for providing winter refugia for Anagaris based on California models, but using different plants to provide an overwinter environment for egg parasitoids, and minimizing the time and distance between the overwintering sites of Anagaris and the vineyard, so that they got in earlier and started biologically controlling earlier. This obviously went hand in hand with trying to persuade the growers to use or to not use chlorpyrifos, Lordsman, and to use some more selective materials. Anagaris is a powerful enemy of leafhoppers as long as it's present when the first generation of eggs is laid. That's a key thing, and that's what we were trying to do. And so, you know, roses in vineyards or in the vicinity, we found are an ideal habitat for overwintering Anagaris and do improve biological control. So a number of vineyards now use this strategy. Also, blackberries are grown. That's another host. The alternative leafhopper hosts are rose leafhoppers and apple leafhoppers. And so these, you know, colonize these plants in the autumn and overwinter on them. Cutworms, again, can be a devastating pest if you have a lot of cutworms early in the season. They climb up the vine and chew on the buds and kill the buds and you know, reduce fruitfulness, etc. But they tend to be aggregated in small parts of vineyards. They're not widespread over the whole viticultural region. There's certain vineyards are affected almost every year, but sometimes just in one part of a vineyard, one block. But again, you know, at that time, the industry tended to just spray. They weren't really sure. There wasn't good monitoring. There still isn't very good monitoring of cutworms available. So to be on the safe side, sprays were put on just to make sure they didn't have a cutworm problem. And as I said, so these early spring sprays for leaf hoppers and cutworms effectively prevented natural enemy presence for the rest of the season. But today we've developed a new strategy for controlling cutworms based on targeted trunk sprays of synthetic pyrethroids, which is similar to a strategy we used in Australia to control weevils and climbing up trunks too. This is obviously much better. It's more targeted. It doesn't spray the whole canopy, doesn't kill overwintering phytosads that are higher up generally than low down at the base of the canopy. And the cutworms overwinter in the soil, and they climb up the trunks, and the correct application at the correct time of synthetic pyrethroids kills the cutworms before they climb up. And it's been a strategy that's been very rapidly adopted by the industry, you know, removing Lordsman as something that's used early in the season. So that's been a great boon to developing more low import strategies. So now, so the other three pests that I showed in the other slide are largely induced, i.e. they flare up when the pesticides remove natural enemies. And so now that we've gone a long way to removing a lot of those insecticides, the incidence of these other pests has lessened, particularly spider mites, thrips, and also mealybugs. Particularly spider mites. In the last few years, we've rarely, you know, seen any problems with spider mites. But we also did quite a bit of work on spider mites about 3, 4, 5 years ago. A student of mine, Deirdre Prishman, did a lot of work. And apart from the broad spectrum insecticides in the early spring being applied, we also found that disease management, when it's based on multiple applications of sulfur, also had a similar impact on natural enemies, so predatory mites in particular, in reducing their populations. And we did an early survey of pesticide-treated and untreated vineyards, and we found that spider mites, as we thought, were greater in the pesticide-treated vineyards than in the untreated there's a few organic or untreated vineyards at that time, and the phytosad mites were greater in the untreated vineyards. But the greatest population of the spider mites we saw at that time was in vineyards that had up to 13 sulfur sprays and then stopped, and then an explosion of spider mites would occur. So it was more than just the insecticides. Deirdre's work was more detailed and looked at a survey of 40 to 50 vineyards, looking at unsprayed, low input, which we classified as fungicides only, and high input, which is fungicides and insecticides. And as you can see there, the population of the spider mites was very low in unsprayed and the highest in the high input. But it was also not significantly lower in the low input, i.e. the fungicide-only vineyards. And so from this we knew that something was going on with the fungicides. And looking at the phytosads, we have a group of phytosads. One of the major ones at that time was Galandromus occidentalis, a specialist phytosad feeding solely on spider mites, and there didn't appear to be much difference between those three types of vineyards. But with the generalist phytosad densities, and there's a whole group of them that are listed there, there was a significant difference in their occurrence. We didn't see hardly any of those in the high or low input vineyards that are mostly in the untreated vineyards. And these are very important, these generalist phytosads, as we learnt from our work in Australia. Dorian and Victoria are generalist phytosads. And this shows the impact of sulfur on spider mites. So according to the number of sprays of sulfur applied, the more sprays of sulfur applied, the more spider mites vineyards used to seem to have. So pesticide sprays at that time contributed to larger populations of spider mites and smaller populations of predatory mites. And the key detrimental components were chlorpyrifos, carbaryl, and sulfur. So that early season program of chlorpyrifos and carbaryl and multiple sulfur program was widely used up until about 2005. And you know, until that time, spider mite outbreaks were common in mid to late season. But since that time, the use of those broad spectrum insecticides and the multiple sulfur sprays have declined, and mite outbreaks have, as I said, have become very infrequent. In the last 3 or 4 years, you know, count on one hand how many outbreaks we've had. But we've had a new pest appear, and this is a throwback to the Australian situation again. This is one of the pests I was controlling with Dorian Victoria. Finally followed me to Washington. As a consequence, I believe, of the lessening of broad spectrum inputs. It's probably always been in Washington vineyards, but just been obliterated by the use of the broad spectrum pesticides. This is the sort of damage it causes in the summer. A bronzing can get more severe than that, but it's not really an economic problem, the bronzing. It's a good indication you've got the mites, but this is the economic damage it causes in early spring. You have very large populations on developing shoots, and you get this reduced growth syndrome, as it's called in Australia, or short shoot syndrome in Washington and Oregon. But you need, you know, a lot of mites to cause this sort of damage. And in 2006, we had a major outbreak in one of our viticultural regions, and really alarmed the industry. But as I mentioned before, along with conservation of phytosad mites, a strategy of well-timed sulfur sprays has been developed in Australia by Martina Bernard, and that was very successful. So we adopted that, and it's worked very well. So just the application of two sprays of sulfur early season, just prior to bud burst and just after bud burst, is very effective in controlling. Bringing down the populations of the mites so that they don't cause the damage that they can cause at that time. So I've been selling Great Leaf Rust Mite as Friends of Washington Viticulture. It's an indication of how low input and sustainable grape production has become. As I said, they've probably always been there, just obliterated by the pesticide. The other key thing that we've done over the last almost 10 years is develop a database of pesticide safety to beneficial arthropods, so we can tell the growers, you know, don't use Lord's Ban, but use bifenazate, which is an acaricide. And so we get lists of chemicals available for different beneficials, which are safe and which are harmful. And that's played a big role in creating sustainable and low input management. And then recently, some colleagues of mine did a survey of pesticide use in Washington viticulture compared to a previous survey that was done in the 1990s. and it was quite remarkable what they found. Insecticide and miticide use has dropped since 1985 by about 84%, and there's been 15-fold reductions in chlorpyrifos and carbyl use, and I'd say it's probably even more than that actually. A lot of vineyards don't use chlorpyrifos or carbyl at all. So it's now as low input as Australian viticulture, I believe, and very few disruptive pesticides are used in either system. So why did Washington viticulture change? It wasn't for the export story, but it was multiple factors, I think. Restriction on pesticide use, as we heard earlier, was a key thing. You know, pesticides becoming less available, the ones they were using. Increasing environmental awareness. I mean, I've noticed how much more aware the public is now than it was 10 years ago. And public pressure coming from that. And of course, I'd like to think that we played a role too in developing management strategies that were more compatible with low input viticulture. And so the future, I'm still working in viticulture in Washington. I don't plan to move to another continent yet. You heard before about HIPPOs, or herbivore-induced plant protection odors, as I call them, along with attract and reward, which is Steve Ratten's idea. It's a great concept, and it's working very well for us in Washington viticulture. We've been trialing dispensers rather than applying insecticide or spray mixtures, just using dispensers, and we've attracted a great number of beneficials. These are just representatives of some of the families we've attracted, and it's caused suppression of pests in some instances. And this quickly shows some percentage abundance of the different beneficial insect groups in the methyl salicylate baited versus unbaited vineyards in 2005. So that's a piece of work we're continuing. And we're also moving on to more sustainable things, and I have to give credit to Steve Ratten here for putting this idea in my head a couple of years ago. We're now looking at ground covers and refugia, beauty with benefits, I'm going to call it, which is developing vineyard refugia for beneficials, but also butterflies, because in my spare time, I'm a lepidopterist, and I want to combine the two things. So we're going to restore native ecosystems within and around vineyards to improve conservation biological control for native plant and butterfly conservation. And of course, I'm hopeful that the industry will think it's a great idea from terms of image, marketing and tourism for viticulture. And Steve Ratten has a good model for this being successful in New Zealand. And so this is something I'm very excited about at the moment. And with that, I'd like to thank all my Australian and American technicians, there's been many over the years, the great growers and funding agencies. Thank you.